Good morning. Some of you may already know, we had a good week. We traveled to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania to be a part of the Churches of God Triannual Conference. It was kind of interesting. This year it was the 200th anniversary of the denomination as a whole. So they've been doing this for a while. It was kind of interesting. I did not fully understand that our history as a fellowship of churches went back before the Civil War. And so we got to hear and experience some of the interesting pieces on that. There's actually a documentary about John Weinbrenner. One of the reasons they did it in Harrisburg this year as a conference was because that's where he had his first church and where he's buried. And so... there was a small documentary film that the denomination put together that kind of highlights some of the history of where we've been. And then we talked a lot about where we're going. One of the things I think that the church here would be interested in is that there was an emphasis on this idea of what we call fresh expressions of ministry. As you look back through the history of the church, all the way back into the early church, the idea of having buildings and filling buildings and having what we call an attractional worship service where we plan it and say, y'all come, it's pretty short on the timeline as that we've been doing this. And it had a lot of success for a number of years, but as you look around, it's not just our church. Churches all over the country are struggling to bring in and lead new people to Jesus with the mindset of, we're going to do it here. Why don't you come join us? And there's a lot of reasons for that. But one of the statistics that we talked about is that in fresh expressions, if you took 100 people in one church, oftentimes that church will average about one conversion, maybe one or two baptisms a year out of 100. But if you take that 100 people and break it up into groups of 10 or 20, oftentimes, each of those groups of 10 or 20 will see a couple of salvations and a couple of baptisms a year. And so we look at it, if taking 100 people and going down to the shelter house at the park and going to the nursing home and going into maybe the dock at the lake or wherever, the living room, all of these places, and choosing to worship and those environments, if it brings more people into the kingdom, it's something that we have to look at and we have to wrestle with. Because God is moving, especially if we pay attention. And so it doesn't mean to discourage us. I think that when we average 20-some on a Sunday, we're right in that kind of average of where a lot of the churches are today. We'd like to see more people, but what happens is that as we're smaller, we're forced to, we have this ability to do discipleship. And when we make disciples, eventually we'll see a bigger church. If we do church and we go through the motions of it, it doesn't mean that we make disciples. It doesn't mean that we're seeing people come to Jesus. We hope it happens. But if we put all of our energy and attention into how do we lead people to Jesus and disciple them, there is no other outcome than the growth of the church. And so those were things that we wrestled with and we talked about at conference. We're not trying to blow the whole thing up and do it different. We've done enough of that over the years. But we're going to be praying together about what does God have for us and what are the opportunities like the nursing home, maybe the community center across the street where we could go and do worship there just like we do it here. Where we could bring and be missionaries to different corners of our neighborhood and our city to make disciples, to build relationships. One of the stories that we heard at conference, it was a fun one, is that we now have in the Churches of God a bar church. It's out in kind of the country in the middle of nowhere, and there was a bar, and one day the pastor got a phone call that one of his parishioners was having a heart attack at the bar and that he wouldn't let the ambulance take him until pastor got there. And so the pastor rushed over there. He prayed with him. He got to know the bar owner. And the bar owner said, you know what, I've never stepped foot in a church, and I don't think I would want to. But if you came and preached here, I'd listen. And so he had the opportunity. They made a big deal. And again, maybe I don't care as much about this, but they said, no beer is served on Sunday morning. That's fine. But they've got a growing group, and they've had baptisms and salvations because they chose to say, you know what? These folks may have been a little hungover from Saturday night, but we're going to welcome into worship Sunday morning at the bar. And again, it sounds fun, but it's far less romantic when you get there. If you've ever been, and I worked at a country club, so if you ever go and try and clean up and open up on Saturday morning after a rowdy Friday night, it's filled with the smell of stale beer and just, ugh. So it's not the place I would choose to be the worship service, but it was a safe place for those who were used to being there. And that's what we have to begin to think and wrestle with. And so I think it's a good segue as we start to talk about our transition into the book of Ruth and what God was doing then and what he could be doing now. On the way home, we had a fun time. We made a trip to Put-in Bay. I don't know, has anybody ever been to Put-in Bay? It's kind of neat if you haven't been. It was a little rowdy, but we didn't participate in any of the rowdiness. Probably a few too many bachelorette parties on the island on a Friday, but it was neat. We kind of putzed around in a little golf cart. We took the Jet Express over. But one of the things that Beth and I and Jeffrey did, the rest of the kids, kind of the girls wanted to explore on their own. We went to a crystal cave. It was the world's largest geode. I would say that also makes it the world's smallest cave. It wasn't very big. It felt kind of tourist trappy, but it was neat to see you walk inside the geode. And part of that, it's on the property of a winery. So we were on the winery, and this winery's won a bunch of awards. They actually found the cave when they were trying to dig for a well to be able to help have more water. They still to this day don't have a well, but they have a cave that like $3 a person or $12 for the whole deal gets you a little bit of a tour through. But part of it came with a tour of the winery. So, and by the winery, they meant the facilities that they make the wine. And everyone was asking, well, when do we get to see the grapes? When do we get to see the fields? And they said, you don't want to see the fields. There's hardly anything going on in the fields. They're still growing. The grapes are still growing. Others would ask, well, why aren't you making wine today? And again, it went back to, we're growing grapes right now. Come August, we'll start picking the first grapes. And then in November, we'll be making wine throughout the winter. And it was hard for people to understand. It was like, why don't you've got all this equipment sitting here. Why aren't you using it? Why aren't you doing something with it? Obviously, they weren't thinking like a farmer. Because in the world of farming, you have times when you gather and you bring in the crop, but that's not all the time. There's also times that you scatter seed. And it's this alternating pattern of scattering seed and putting the seed out there. And the seed actually has to go through a death in the field. The seed changes, it decays. And then it grows and there becomes this harvest. And then a part of that harvest gets to be returned and scattered again. And if we're honest, there are many things in life where we experience this pattern of being gathered in and scattered out. Gathered in and scattered out. And we like the gathering. The gathering feels good. We enjoy the harvest because the harvest is plentiful. You know, we all get enough pumpkin spice in the fall, right? There's so much because there's apples everywhere. There's all of this abundance in the harvest. But then as we go scatter, and at the time that you scatter, if you're a farmer, this is when your reserves are at their lowest. You're taking a part of that crop, the seeds, the fruit, the grain. And now you're taking a piece of it and you're scattering it out so that you can have another harvest. For us to understand the book of Ruth, we have to put our mind into the idea of gathering and scattering. And we have to see that this is an important rhythm, not just for Ruth, not just for farmers, but it's an important part of our spiritual dynamic. It's an important part of our gathering together, that God will gather us in to lean on one another, to encourage one another, to do church together, to be the church together, but He will also scatter us out. And if we get too comfortable together and we never become scattered out, then there won't be that next harvest. Imagine for a moment if the farmers said, you know what? I don't really want to plant a field today. That's a whole lot of grain. It's a lot of corn. That's a lot of soy that I have to put back into the field, potato, whatever. I think this year I'm not going to do it. We'll just eat it. If they did that the following year, they would starve, especially if they couldn't go to Kroger or Walmart and buy another meal. And in the church, I fear that we've gone through generations where we've been really comfortable gathering, but we didn't plant that next harvest. We didn't scatter. And if we don't do it, God, in His abundant love for us, in His discipline of those He loves, in His desire to see His will accomplished and His power to make it happen, sometimes if we don't scatter, God will scatter for us. And that's what we saw in the days of the judges when Ruth's story is told. We'll start in Ruth chapter 1. We're going to read through the whole chapter in segments today. In the days when the judges ruled, so this again, this is a judge's story. This is not another time period. We're back into the time of judges. Naomi's story likely begins before Samson and the return from Moab to Bethlehem is likely, again, we don't have perfect indicators, but is likely at the tail end or during that 20 years of prosperity and peace that Samson's judge and kind of his administration of Israel provides. So in the days of the judges, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judea, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, and they were Ephraimites, so they were from Ephraim's tribe, from Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to Moab and they lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. So the first person I want us to look at, we're going to compare Naomi and Orpah and Ruth because they all play significant parts in this story and they all come to it from a different place. So in Naomi, we see a life that is scattered in grief. We see what happens when God has to scatter for us, when He has to push the toothpaste tube. It's hard to get it back in. It's kind of like we see with some of the baby birds or the hawks, some of the large birds of prey. When it's time for the baby to get out of the nest, they don't gently nudge the baby. They take them and fly them up from a height and they drop them. And they don't have much of a choice. It's either fall and possibly die. Now mama often swoops in or fly. Naomi's life was filled with pain and scattering, famine, displacement, loss, and poverty. She's born in Judea. She knows from her childhood the stories of what God has done, but she's there in a time of wickedness, in a time of unfaithfulness of God's people, and so famine comes in. But the famine wasn't universal. And again, in the Middle East, we often think of this as a really big place, but America is a big place. The Middle East is like, you know, the size of a couple of states. And there, if you look at the map, and the map today, we have two areas. We have the West Bank and we have Gaza that are in the news a lot. Well, in the land of Gaza, a little bit bigger back then, but that's where the Philistines lived, right there up against the sea. And there on the other side of the Jordan River was Moab, kind of a little bit to the east and south, in where we would call the West Bank area today. And at this time, the people of Israel weren't at war with Moab. That had kind of run its course. There was a degree of peace, and historically it looks like they were taking refugees. They were welcoming them in. And the Philistines, as we saw in the story of Samson, became the antagonist. And they've kind of been Israel's antagonist there in the Gaza area for a long time. So Moab down, West Bank into Jordan, and then the Philistines and what would be the Gaza Strip, a little bit larger than that today. But they go to Moab because they're hungry. They don't wait on God. Elimelech and his wife Naomi, they go, they start something new. There they have two sons, and their two sons marry local women, as would often happen. But not long, 10 years later, Naomi becomes a widow. Some of you know what that's like, and it's painful. So she leaves the home of her family because of famine. She's displaced. She's a refugee. That's painful. That's hard. She goes, she loses her husband. That's painful. That's hard. And then no parent wants to put their child in the grave. No parent wants to be present at their child's funeral. She gets to be present for both of her sons' funerals. They have young wives left behind. It's a difficult season. And now she's in poverty and there's famine in Moab and she's not really a Moabite. When things are prosperous in a community, everybody does well. But when things get hard, and we've even seen it here in our attitudes, when things get hard, when there's war in the world, when we don't trust our neighbors, it's those who don't look like us. It's those who don't share our national identity. Those are the ones that we first push out on the fringes. And that was Naomi's story. So her life has been challenging. And now she needs to return home. And she knows that in Israel, they haven't been super nice to those who have gone somewhere else, those who abandoned ship and then came back because now things are okay. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised by that because we do the same thing with sports teams. What do we say if the Cubs are having a great year, if the Bears are doing well, if the Colts are playing good? Oh, those are just fair weather fans. They weren't there to root for them when they were losing all the games, when things were hard, when things were bad. Well, if we do that with football or baseball, how much more do we do that with our community and our identity? The history shows us that Naomi had to have been somewhat worried about what it was going to be like to come back. She wasn't coming back victorious. She wasn't coming back wealthy. She was coming back again, a double refugee. A refugee to Moab, not a Moabite, and then a refugee back to Bethlehem, not really in their eyes an Israelite anymore. Someone who had left. So she's not excited about this. In fact, if we go down to verse 20, we get a picture inside Naomi's mind when she says, "Don't call me Naomi," she told them, "call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter." See, Naomi means pleasant. That's what the name means. And she's like, don't call me pleasant anymore. You call me bitter. Because that's how she feels. This is a woman who's going through struggle. She has been scattered in grief, and she has been scattered in grief more than most of us. I don't know all your stories. I'm not trying to judge it up against. And that comparison thing doesn't lead us anywhere good anyways. But she's going through significant pain. And I think it's important for us to see that God had his hand in it. God is either sovereign or he's not. There are times we try and praise God for the good things, but we don't give God credit for the hard things that we go in, not understanding that those hard things, that scattering can be very good, can be very productive to build God's kingdom, to build character in us. I've been asked before, what's the one thing we can't do in heaven? There's like a couple of them. We can't sin in heaven. We also, I don't think we can build character in heaven. Because character is what happens when we have to make decisions and go through suffering, and that won't be present. So we take with us the character that we've been built and shaped with under pressure here. And that's one of the reasons I believe that God cares more about our character and what we can do in partnership to build the kingdom than he does about our comfort level. Because in reality, almost anything worth doing, almost anything productive, almost anything good, it's painful. If you ever go to the gym and try and get strong, you're tearing muscle fibers apart. It's painful. If you want to get endurance and build your cardiovascular system, you have to push yourself beyond, and it's painful. If you want to learn new skills, it can be frustrating and painful. Very few things work through. If you want to be married, it's great, young people. It should be on your aspirational list. But it's also hard and painful. Because that promise you make to the other person, it's not just for the good days. It's for the hard days too. So Naomi is scattered by God, by God's design, in his plan and purpose. She has been put through pain, and now she says, don't call me pleasant, call me bitter. Because my life has been bitter. And some of that's true. And God isn't harsh with Naomi. In fact, the story gets good for Naomi from this point forward. God does good things for her. God uses her and uses Ruth and does amazing things, not just for her, but for generations to come. But I think we've all had moments where we felt like Naomi. God, don't call me pleasant today. Where you get to work and get a cup of coffee and somebody says, have a nice day, and you say, don't tell me what kind of day I'm having. Not having a nice day. Don't call me pleasant. Call me bitter. And I'm not saying that's right. But as we're walking through the grief and the suffering, God understands. And he's waiting for us to say, okay, God, I don't know what you're doing, but I trust you. And Naomi, at the end of the day, she trusts God and she returns in all of that hardship. She goes down the road and says, I'm returning home. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud. And said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there were still hope for me, and this is going to creep out the other girls in the room, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you raise them from infancy alongside me and then marry these younger men? Would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me. At this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. So we see Orpah, and Orpah is a different story. Naomi was scattered by grief and scattered by God's work to do something, to build something, to be a gathering later. But Orpah, she's scattered by her own sense and her own logic. Orpah counts the cost of following and decides to return home to her father's gods. She turns away from the gods of Israel, and she decides to go back and worship the household gods, the idols, because there is a warm meal, there is a safe bed, a roof over her head. And I'm not blaming her for that decision. I think it probably seemed very rational. And Naomi was pushing her and saying, this is a hard road ahead. Don't go back home. You'll be safe there. You'll be fed there. Orpah kisses her mother-in-law goodbye. And then again, we see your sister-in-law is going back to her people and to her gods. We will encounter so many people in our life that are just not people of peace. And it doesn't mean they will never be people of peace. But in that moment, they are not people of peace. And we have to just dust off our clothes and continue on, trusting that God is putting people of peace in our life. But here we see that God is doing something to accomplish the promise that He made to Abraham, that his seed, that his children, that his tribe would not be. The promise to Abraham was not that your people would be an antagonist to the world and would cause many wars and much strife. That's not the promise. The promise is that from Abraham's tribe, from his family, there would be peace and hope and reconciliation, that his family would be a blessing to the world, that they would be a lighthouse, that they would be this shining example of bringing people from all over the world into God's family. That was the promise. But it hasn't happened yet. And some of that was the foolishness of Abraham. We see he gets this promise and he goes into Egypt and he says, nope, she's my sister. Problems happen. We see the Exodus. It doesn't go well. There's a picture that it might work out with Joseph, but years later it turns. We see that the days of conquest didn't seem like blessing to the neighbors, but here we see a glimpse of it. As they lived in peace in Moab, and now Naomi had brought in these two daughters-in-law to teach them the ways of the Lord. But Orpah, even though she's been worshiping, even though she's been living in the family, in the household of God, she says, you know what? You're right. A warm meal and a solid house and a bed to sleep in is more important today. So I'll go back and I'll return to my father's gods. We grieve for this, and you should. When we invest in somebody and we live out that parable of the sower, that as we scatter out seed, and that's, you know, we think of seeds these days as being not that valuable, but back then it was very valuable. We're making investments in people's lives, and some of those seeds will fall on fertile soil, and that's fantastic, and we celebrate that. And some of those seeds will fall in the cracks in the road, and they'll come up for a time, and then the wind and the water and the traffic will trample them and uproot them, and that may have been Orpah's story. Others will just hit rock-hard stone, and they'll never sprout. And again, these seeds, they're not like grass seeds where you get to buy a bag for a few dollars down at Lowe's, these seeds are representative of past harvest and hardship and toil and work. But as we sow seeds, some seeds just won't grow, but enough of them will. If we look for people of peace, if we continue to invest, if we continue to sow and to scatter seed, God will bring the harvest. But we can't be frustrated when sometimes in some lives it doesn't happen. But Ruth replied. So we heard Orpah's answer. At first she said, I'll go with you. And then she says, okay, you're right. I'll go home. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. See the big G's here? Not those household gods, but your God Almighty will be my God Almighty. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. Naomi is beginning to see the fruits of blessing that God didn't just bring anyone into her life. God brought Ruth into her life. This is far more than she could have expected, because Ruth was still a beautiful woman. Ruth was still young enough, but Naomi, she couldn't attract attention. She wasn't going to attract another husband. Ruth could, and Ruth is saying, wherever you go, I go. Wherever you're buried, I'm buried. We are in this together. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went out until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, can this be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Lord Almighty, or because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full. And she didn't go away full. She went away in famine. But she says, I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. It's amazing how we frame things sometimes, isn't it? We say, oh, I had it so bad, when maybe we didn't. And our body starts to believe the things that we say. Oh, it's been such a stressful week. And we feel it inside. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Ruth is a story to be gathered by grace. There is no Ruth without Naomi being scattered. Ruth would have grown up in Moab. She would have worshipped false gods. She would have died, and her story would have never been told and remembered. None of us are reading the Moabite Chronicles, if there even are any. But Naomi was scattered. She was sent out in grief, in suffering, in pain, in bitterness. And her scattering helped her gather and harvest the life of Ruth. And I think I said something wrong last week. I said that she was like the great-great-great-grandmother of Jesus. Maybe that's totally wrong. Not Jesus, David. She's the great-grandmother of David, King David, who is in the direct genealogy of Jesus, but it takes a few more years and generations. I was like, as soon as I said it last week, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. So I did some homework on that. But Ruth, her story becomes so important. And she becomes a picture of adoption and what God is doing. Ruth chooses covenant over comfort. She could have gone back home just like Opfer did, but she said, I will take this hard journey. I will face the uncertainty because I have made a promise to you. She stands by Naomi. She stands by the God of Naomi, the God that her husband served, the God that her grandfather served, not the God of her household. Something has stirred in her. God has moved in her. There must have been enough of an experience with God that she knew this was what was right and what was real. And she walked away from that she grew up with. She chooses covenant over comfort, and she becomes the first fruits of God's redemptive plan here. Again, God isn't about war with the neighbors. His plan from the beginning was for Israel to be a form of adoption that all of the other nations, and we see it in Jesus, and we see it with the Apostle Paul on his missionary journeys, but they gather in those from Corinth and Ephesus and all of these other pagan places and say, now you can all come and be part of this redemptive, beautiful thing that God is doing. The gospel isn't just for the people of Israel. It's for all nations. It's for all people to be restored and brought into relationship with God. Something new is happening. And Ruth says it so beautifully, where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. You may lose an Ophrah along the way, but if you gain a Ruth, you will have done well. And there is no harvest in Ruth's life without Naomi being scattered. I want you to just to think about that deeply for a moment. Your story of salvation, your story of coming into the kingdom of God, it doesn't happen unless someone else was scattered out. Oftentimes in grief and in discomfort, even if it's just the discomfort of walking across the street, of making themselves vulnerable and saying, can I tell you about my Jesus? Knowing that they might be ridiculed, that the door might be shut, that they might be assumed to be just another Jehovah's Witness or Mormon knocking on the door. I don't know what level of scattering and grief and bitterness and pain was involved in the stories of those who brought you to Jesus, but if someone wasn't scattered out, if they weren't sent out, you wouldn't have been harvested in. And there is a generation out there that is hurting, that needs Jesus, and they won't be gathered in if we're not scattered out. So what does this mean? This means that sometimes we have to do things that might make us uncomfortable, and that might mean we might have to go worship in a bar someday. I don't know. It might mean that we go worship in the nursing home. And we take a Sunday or two off and say, we're going to turn the lights off here and we're all going to go over there and be scattered and pushed out of the toothpaste tube. And we're going to worship on their turf. We're going to worship at the community center. We're going to worship in the park shelter. Because our identity isn't here and the harvest doesn't happen here. It happens when we are sent and scattered out. Means that we may need to knock on the door of our neighbor and say, what could we do to serve you and love you? What needs do you have? While we were at conference, I took a minute and I read the reviews of our neighborhood next door across the way. And I couldn't tell. The reviews are mixed between the two complexes. And some of you know there's a little bit of a contentious history between the two. But I was looking at it. You know what the number one complaint, and I saw it three different times, was saying this is a terrible place for seniors to live because no one from the community comes and replaces light bulbs and smoke detector batteries. I don't think it's an accident that God had me replace two smoke detector batteries this morning. It's not that hard. And I'm reading that, I'm like, if this is, and I don't know, you don't know until you ask someone who lives there, what are your biggest needs? And one of the most important questions that we can ask is, if a group of well-meaning people were to walk into your community, what could they do to make a significant difference? And oftentimes it'll surprise us because it might just be as simple as it'd be really nice if we had somebody who could walk in and put in some smoke detector batteries and some light bulbs. I can do that. I can do that. We can do that. But it doesn't happen until we leave here and we get scattered out to our neighbors. There is no harvest without a scattering, without the bitterness and decay of the seed going into ground. Without Naomi being made bitter. And again, maybe she could have done that better. I'm not here to judge Naomi. But if it wasn't for Naomi's pain, there would be no Ruth. And Ruth is worth the pain. For each of us, I've asked you to pray this over the past weeks, but continue to pray. Who's your Ruth going to be? Who is God calling you to scatter your life out for, to sacrifice for, so that maybe they would come into the kingdom of God with us? Because we're 20 people, about. If we lead two people to Jesus, we've blown away the national average. Which is sad. That's two people. Could you lead one or two of those people to Jesus this year? What if all 20 of us led someone to Christ this year? That would blow away the national average. But it's not about numbers and it's not about prizes. It's not so the national office can give us a sticker and say, good job. It's because these people matter to God. And they should matter to us. But the only way we reach them is if we scatter, if we pour ourselves out, if we move away from some of the things that are comfortable, if we allow God to prune, not necessarily bad things, just unnecessary things from our life so that we can be a part of a bigger harvest. So again, there is no Ruth without Naomi's pain. And for God to use you to build the kingdom, there will be pain and there will be scattering. But if we see it in God's eyes through the light of what He's doing, I promise you it will be good.